From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, April 16th, 2019.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Red Zone Wireless, providing a local alternative for broadband throughout Maine. Learn more at redzonewireless.com.
The administration of Governor Janet Mills is developing a program that would stock all the state's high schools and middle schools with the overdose antidote drug naloxone. That's according to the Portland Press-Herald. The Maine Attorney General's office says 418 people died in Maine from overdoses in 2017. A legislative panel is considering a measure that would expand the number of growers on a commission that promotes the state's wild blueberry industry. Currently, there are 8 members on the Wild Blueberry Commission of Maine, including 5 processors. The legislation would hike the number of grower representatives from 3 to 5, increasing commission membership to 10. Wild Blueberry Commission Interim Executive Director Patricia Contour says it's the industry's best interest to have growers and processors working together on key issues and initiatives.
Having a more diverse board structure would reflect the broader grower perspective. Also, we wanted to make sure that we responded to a desire for change from the grower community.
Maine's wild blueberry industry has seen a downward trend in recent years. Contour says there's been more competition from cultivated blueberries and Canadian wild blueberries. She says the commission's optimistic that following some new marketing efforts, the downturn has ended and things are headed back up. A committee vote is likely on Thursday. And new research from the University of New Hampshire shows a decline among some of the wild bees that pollinate important New England fruit crops. NHPR's Annie Ropeek has more.
A survey of 125 years of records shows at least a dozen wild bee species are in decline in the Northeast. UNH Assistant Professor Sandra Rehan says these bees are better suited than honeybees to pollinate key native plants like blueberries, apples, and cranberries. But they may share some of the honeybee's threats, including new pathogens which originate in honeybee hives and spread across species.
So much like we contract diseases through subways and airplanes, so do bees. Their hubs of interaction and activity are flowers.
Rehan says other common threats which humans could mitigate include overuse of pesticides, a lack of seasonal wild plant diversity, and a warming climate that's shrinking the bees' habitat. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Annie Ropeek.
In weather tonight, clouds and flurries in the north, partly cloudy in the south, breezy overnight with lows in the low 20s to mid-30s, mountains to the coast. Tomorrow, mostly sunny statewide with highs in the mid-40s to mid-50s, north to south. Federal fisheries regulators today demonstrated a new risk assessment tool aimed at helping the survival of the North Atlantic right whale. Fred Bever reports it comes on the eve of regulatory decisions that could affect the fate of the endangered species and also the lobster industry.
Federal scientists say the new data model should help lobstermen and conservationists make collaborative decisions about reducing dangers that fishing gear poses for the endangered species. But in a webinar presentation, the model got a skeptical reception from some stakeholders who are preparing for what could be a decisive meeting on the issue next week.
To have a government agency a week before a meeting say, this is the best that we have, deal with it, is very disturbing.
Patrice McCarron is executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. She says that the model predicted, for instance, that one of the highest risk situations the whales face is near the Maine shore in early winter. That's a time, she says, when whales are not congregating in the area and most Maine lobstermen are taking a break.
The preliminary run of the model doesn't really seem to make sense based on what we know about the fishery. So I think it's the right approach, but I don't think that this model is ready for prime time.
McCarron is part of a broad team of stakeholders called the Take Reduction Team. They convene next week in Providence to seek consensus on changes in gear and fishing practices that would reduce the risk of whales being entangled in the rope that's used to haul traps. The scientists promise that they will continue to refine and add more data to the risk assessment tool, but McCarron says consensus still may be hard to achieve, in which case federal fishery managers have ultimate authority. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
Maine is seeing more and more young people from preschool through 12th grade who are homeless. They're moving into shelters, sleeping on couches, and in rare cases, camping or living in cars. According to the National Center for Homeless Education, the numbers increased by 30% in just 2 years. As part of our week-long series, Finding a Way, Maine Public's Robbie Feinberg brings us the story behind those numbers and what that increase has meant for kids and the schools and communities trying to help them.
Most afternoons, 18-year-old Michaela, she asks that we not use her last name, sits by herself, hunched over a computer or notepad in a back office at New Beginnings, a shelter in Lewiston for youth who are homeless or displaced. Here, she writes stories and letters to help her process what she's experienced over the past few years.
Like, even, like, reading that piece is hard, but it, like, it gives me a more positive memory to all of these traumatic events than what I usually would think about.
Michaela arrived in Maine about 3 years ago from Connecticut, where she and her sisters had been raised by their single dad. When he passed away, they moved to Biddeford to be with family. Michaela graduated from high school and even enrolled in community college last fall. But she says without an adult to turn to, she didn't know how to handle financial aid or pay for books.
It was really hard to even think about who would I even call, because my family, like I said, like being first generation, they wouldn't even really know. So it's like me asking them questions and being like, who do I call? How do I do this? And so like I was literally just living in the dorms, but like not going to classes because I didn't have books and I wasn't doing much of actual school. So I was like, well, I think it's time to just drop out as opposed to paying tuition for nothing.
She did drop out. But once she left the dorm, she had few options of where to go. Michaela says she stayed with her grandmother for a bit, but was asked to leave after repeated family conflicts. She says her boyfriend's sister paid for a hotel for a few nights. But without permanent shelter, Michaela and her boyfriend passed the time in 24-hour fast food restaurants just to have a roof over their heads.
My friend let me stay in, like, her hallway outside, like, of her actual apartment. Like, we would stay there, or, like, there were other nights where we would just be sitting outside kind of trying to figure something out. But it was just months of kind of panicking, and that's really all we could think about.
Michaela is one of a growing number of Maine youth identified as homeless or displaced. According to one measure done in 2017, more than 2,500 students were without a safe or permanent place to live. That's a 30% jump from 2 years prior. The problem is placing pressure on schools and social service agencies across the state, stretching a system that's already seen some cutbacks in recent years.
We're not alone in that. It has been a trend across the country.
Gail Erdheim of the Maine Department of Education works with public schools to support students who are homeless or displaced. Erdheim says that it's hard to point to any single factor that's causing youth homelessness to rise. She says it may be partially the result of better reporting and recently reauthorized policies that require schools to put more effort into identifying displaced students.
In terms of kind of keying schools into the value of bending over backward to keep kids stable in the school that they've been in, even when they're moving around.
But advocates for youth in Maine point to larger societal problems as part of the explanation that's driving the trend. They include a lack of affordable housing, especially in southern Maine. The problem is compounded for the many immigrant families and youth who arrive in Portland shelters, often seeking asylum from violence in their home countries. Susan Wiggin is the transition specialist for Portland Public Schools.
So the folks that we see don't have help, don't have caseworkers, don't have jobs, don't have legal standing. They have the clothes that they're wearing, and that's it. And so when we have to do a lot of shoring up in our schools from elementary all the way through.
In more rural areas, there are other destabilizing factors: intergenerational poverty, the opioid epidemic, and discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Melissa McEntee, the executive director of Rumford Group Homes in Oxford County, says the public may not grasp what's actually happening.
But I think one of the biggest myths that we see is people think it's just runaways who don't want to live under their parents' roofs with their parents' rules. And that's just clearly not what we saw. It was youth that faced a lot of family conflict, youth that were coming from homes where there were major issues with substance use, domestic violence, and youth that were just not able to safely live in their homes.
The state has a network of connected shelters and support services to help, and school districts are required to identify homeless students and provide education, transportation, and support under the federal McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. In Biddeford, officials say the school department has seen its busing costs rise by 40% in the past 5 years. At times, the district has relied on taxis to help get some homeless or displaced students to school. Superintendent Jeremy Ray says there's been an effort to address trauma and hire more social workers in recent years, but the complicated needs pose a challenge.
As we look at doing work with students who experience trauma and all of those pieces, where does it all fit in? How does that flow out and fit into the standards that teachers are required to teach, and that we can actually try to do a good job at everything? And I'm not sure that our setup in 7 hours allows us to do that.
For kids who have aged out of the school system, there is a network of shelters that offer support. For 18-year-old Michaela, that support came from the New Beginnings shelter in Lewiston. She says getting counseling and a place to sleep has made a big difference in her life since she arrived about a month ago. She flips through a study book and says she hopes to give community college another try this fall.
So I definitely feel a lot better now that I've had, you know, somewhere to be where I have resources around me, and I've had, you know, time to not have chaos and be able to figure everything else out that I need to on my own.
While Michaela has found help in a city shelter, homeless young people in rural Maine still face separate persistent challenges on their own, with no easy solutions in sight. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And tomorrow we'll hear about that challenge and the difficult decisions that young homeless people in rural communities are forced to make. Our reporting on issues affecting teenagers and young adults in Maine is made possible with support from the John T. Gorman Foundation. And New York University's College of Dentistry operates outreach programs that routinely send its dental interns to far-off locales like Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Cambodia. But last week, the 40-member team returned to Maine's Washington County, where financial and transportation barriers prevent many Downeast families from getting much-needed dental care. Working with groups including Northeast Delta Dental and regional healthcare organizations, the NYU students treated about 550 kids and adults during their week-long stay in Machias. A.J. Higgins was there.
Children and adults begin arriving at the Lee Pellin Event Center in Machias an hour before the NYU dentistry students and faculty opened their free clinic in the 60 by 60 foot room. One half of the space was dedicated to pediatric dental services, while the other was reserved for those requiring more serious procedures such as extractions and root canals. Teresa Alley, the oral health coordinator for the Washington County Children's Program, has watched NYU's Machias Clinic expand over the last 9 years. But while Alley has seen the levels of tooth decay decline among the clinic's returning patients, she says continuity of care remains a major issue in Washington County.
There are 7 dentists in Washington County, and we have a population of about 33,000. We've had 2 dentists in the last 2 years retire. So this is the fewest amount of dentists that we've had.
Allie says many of the patients who visited the Machias Clinic last week may not see a dentist again for another year. Still, that's better than where many Washington County residents were in 2010 when the NYU dentistry students first started visiting the region. At that time, Allie said tooth decay rates were running as high as 45% for many of the children visiting the clinic. She says that decay rate is now down to less than 20% among the returning patients. Allie says her recent conversation with a young boy experiencing dental pain is pretty typical of many Washington County families.
And what he told me was, Mom says we can go to the dentist when we get a new wheel on the car. So how do you deal with that? How do you know that this situation is happening? And how do you go to the next level to help? We will see about 1,000 children in a year. And that story is true for many children. It isn't just this one child.
Like other Washington County moms, Erica Robinson of Jonesport packed her 2 sons off to see the NYU dentists. And if her daughter hadn't contracted a cold, she would have brought her too. Robinson said it's hard for many parents in the county to even enter into a working agreement with some area dentists.
No one does like payment plans. There's very few sliding scale fees, and even those are really expensive sometimes. So this is a really great opportunity to get the kids just looked at, and even for yourself.
The NYU dental students have experienced working in a number of other countries where dental services are scarce and poverty rates are high. In that respect, dentist Magdalena Concha says Washington County is similar to rural areas near her hometown of Santiago, Chile, especially when it comes to the centralization of professional services in large cities.
It is interesting to see that even though I'm from Chile, very far away from here, we face some things that are in common. Everything is centralized in the big cities there, and all the rural areas are pretty out of resources.
Is that painful at all?
Open it up. Concha and Dr. Stuart Hirsch, Vice Dean of International Initiatives for the NYU College of Dentistry, consult over a patient who will require some fillings. Later, Hirsch says he has enjoyed bringing accessible dental health care to Washington County, but he continues to worry about the availability of dental services in one of the state's poorest and remote regions.
It's not exactly a place that dentists flock to. It's financial issues that exist, and the number of people that can afford to have care at private dentists that don't accept Medicaid is a limited number.
According to the America's Health Rankings Group, Maine's rate of a little more than 50 dentists per 100,000 residents in 2018 lags behind the national average of 61 dentists per 100,000 people. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for a conversation about the power of volunteerism. I'm Nora Flaherty.